Good morning.
Could you hold it just a minute?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Make sure the council gets settled. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Watkins, and I'm for the appellant Rush. I would like to reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes? Very well.
Today I'm asking the court to reinstate my client's vacated default judgment. The vacation order, I believe, is void on its face. If my request is granted, the case is over. In the alternative, however, if you don't agree with me, I ask that you reinstate our Consumer Protection Act claim that was dismissed on summary judgment and remand the case for trial. The undisputed facts, and I'll be very brief on these, Mr. Blackburn / Top Notch, it's a DBA, towed my client's 1983 Mercedes to his impound lot. Blackburn received actual notice of an impoundment hearing under the statute, once from Mr. Rush, twice from the district court. Without waiting for a judicial determination, Blackburn auctioned the Mr. Rush's vehicle to himself for $1. On that same day, several vehicles were being auctioned, and all of them for that same price of $1, either to himself, to his daughter, to another family member. Mr. Blackburn ignored the hand-delivered notice of impound. He ignored two written notices of impound from the district court. He ignored my firm's letter of representation.
Okay, we read things before we come out here. So answer this question.
Yes, sir.
Rule 60 refers to final judgments, vacating final judgments,
yes,
and the time after a judgment becomes a final judgment. When did your default judgment, in your view, become a final judgment?
When it disposed of all the claims in the matter.
When you say in the matter, what do you mean by that?
We had resolved the all the claims with the other parties, and the default judgment disposed of the final pieces of the claims that had been filed. Under 54, that is where you have not a full adjudication of all the claims. And so,
and when did the last of the claims against other parties get resolved?
I believe it was the time of our default judgment.
I believe it was 13 months later.
I'm sorry. Why do you believe that?
Because that's when the underlying litigation against all the parties ended.
I was under the impression that the last...
You dismissed your claims against Hartford on July 26, 2013. You obtained a default judgment against Blackburn on July 20, 2012. That's 13 months difference.
I see.
So you agree with me that we measure it from when all the litigation was done, right? That's what you told me earlier, and I was nodding my head in agreement.
I do believe that. Yes.
Okay. And all the litigation was done on July 26 of 2003. That's when your default judgment became a final judgment.
Okay.
Right?
I misunderstood. I thought that the adjudication had occurred, the last part of it, at the default. And it was my error, Your Honor.
Well, yeah, because if we take that view, then it's only from July 26 of 2013 to October 31 of 2013 that lapsed before the motion was brought. So the motion is 4 months later.
Okay.
So it's not barred by the 1 year.
Then,
do you agree with that?
In that case, Your Honor, I would ask then to speak to the CPA claim.
Sure.
The court in this case, there was ample, I believe, evidence in the record to show all of the elements of a CPA claim were present. And the fact that this had happened on that day when my client's vehicle was sold to numerous other people.
You don't brief this, but I'm interested in your answer to this. Neither party calls to the court's attention the provisions of the Washington Administrative Code, which hold as follows. where a timely request has been made for a district or municipal court hearing, and where the vehicle owner has failed to redeem the vehicle. The abandoned vehicle procedure requirements may be followed, but the sale of the vehicle at public auction must not take place until after the court has disposed of the request. So it appears that what happened here was in direct violation of that Washington Administrative Code provision. How does that, if we assume that the code provision existed at the time of the actions in this case, and if we assume that it's dealing with a situation which appears to be on all fours with what we've got, how does that violation of that code provision fit in with the requirements that you need to establish in order to get to the jury on a Consumer Protection Act?
I would say it is analogous to the situation where you have a Washington Administrative Code, where you have insurance claims handling regulations, and where a violation of an insurance claims handling regulation supplies three of the five prongs of a Consumer Protection Act claim. I believe we can show harm, and I believe we can also show that because of that, you also have the potential that the public may be harmed by this type of practice. One of the things that I attempted...
It's not a statute, so it doesn't fall within either one or two, which refer to statutes. Is it your argument that it is relevant to 0933 sub C, which is the capacity to injure other persons?
Yes.
Okay.
That is my point. And I think that the fact that we have a regulation, a WAC regulation that was violated, what I was trying to say is that in deposition, Mr. Blackburn said, oh, I've never been cited, anything like that. I did receive later on and tried to bring that to the court's attention, items from the State Patrol where they had shown that they were investigating him and had been citing him, and he also was signed a consent decree saying that he had violated those. He was running a junkyard without a license. Do you have any other questions, Your Honor? Thank you.
You have your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Jeff Wishko on behalf of Mr. Blackburn. This appeal is not whether there were issues of fact as to whether my client may have done something inappropriate or in violation of an administrative code provision. If he did something wrong, that issue was resolved when we settled the conversion claim. This appeal is about whether there was a Consumer Protection Act showing, and if the court agrees with the trial court that there was no showing of the required elements.
Well, here's my concern. In the briefing in the trial court and in the briefing to us, you were insistent that your client, the impounder of the vehicle, had done nothing contrary to law by selling the vehicle at auction prior to the district court proceeding taking place. Those statements appear to be wrong.
Well, I believe what I said.
Because there is a provision.
There was no statutory violation of the statute. That's what I said.
Well, I'll agree with that. Do you agree with me then, since we're being so charitable to one another, that a Washington Administrative Code provision has the force of law?
It does, but it
so it
doesn't have
so more. What your client acted in violation of law, even if he didn't act in violation of a statute.
That's right. But
okay. If he acted in violation of law, and if the law exists as a police power of the government in order to promulgate that law, how is that violation of the law not relevant to the elements of a Consumer Protection Act claim?
Well, I don't believe a code provision rises to the level of a statute.
I agree with that.
And the statute has to have a legislative declaration of a violation of public policy.
So let's go to Section 3, then. If it's not in 1 or 2, how about 3?
3.
If it exists because of the police power, because there's a danger to the public if the regulation does not exist, how is that not material to the question of whether there is a possibility that such action might endanger other persons in the future?
Because it involved one car, and no one else was affected except one plaintiff.
Well, this time.
Well, there was no showing that this but ever happened before.
Well, or but if your person is violating a law in how he goes about it, and there's testimony that he sold other cars to his sibling or to his children for a dollar, Why doesn't that meet the prima facie requirement of showing that there's a potential that this could injure other persons?
Well, the fact that he buys the car or his daughter buys the car for how much is irrelevant, because the statute allows him to purchase cars at auctions, especially when there are no other bidders.
But the law doesn't allow him to purchase the car at auction prior to the district court proceeding taking place.
Well, and largely that's a function of the fact that the district court proceeding was unilaterally continued ex parte by counsel and moved the thing out a month.
Now we get to another thing where I disagree with you. You take the position that you can just simply ignore the district court finding and treat the district court as if it's, you know, not a real court. But there's a finding from the district court. There's a judgment to which your client was a party, and there's a finding that your client was served. And you have not taken any steps to try and attack that finding. You didn't seek to undo that judgment, and you didn't seek to undo that finding. But yet you persist in your arguments in your briefing in claiming that your client didn't know that was taking place. If it's so that the district court is proceeding according to statute and sending notice to your client, and if it's so that doesn't cause your client to respond to the district court proceeding, doesn't that indicate that there's a potential for repetition?
I don't believe it does. And we need to understand there's nothing in the record suggesting that the district court sent notice of the continued hearing.
Well, if your client had appeared at the original hearing, he would have known about the continued hearing. So that doesn't carry a whole lot of water.
We concede he made an error when he sold the car when he did, and that's why we settled the conversion claim. The issue is whether there was a real potential for repetition of these unusual circumstances. This was a confluence of rare circumstances. Part of those circumstances was getting the continuance.
Well, why is that decided as a matter of law as opposed to just let a jury figure it out, whether that this is so rare that it couldn't happen again?
Well, I mean,
it's unusual that the district court sent notice, but he didn't realize they did. It's unusual that he violated the law by auctioning the car off before the district court proceeding happened. There's no possibility it'll happen again. That sounds like something for a jury to decide whether that argument makes sense.
The district court order was never enforced. Well,
it was. The other gentleman, the other party, paid the sum for the that it was ordered under that judgment.
But the judgment ordered the...
And you were ordered to release the car.
And they never saw it enforced?
Well, they couldn't because you'd sold it.
He had it in his yard. They knew that. They knew he had it in his yard.
Given it back because you sold it.
We offered to give it back on multiple occasions. He didn't want it back. He got a lot more mileage out of not getting the car back than he did if he had redeemed it, because it allowed him to have an insurance claim. It allowed him to get judgments for conversion.
Well, I'll agree with you that bad things happen when businesses don't comply with the law. I mean, if that's the point you're making, I'm sold on that. But what I'm trying to figure out is why there's not a jury question presented. You think the facts are unique or so unusual, but everything seems to be capable of repetition. You don't respond to a district court notice of a hearing. You sell the vehicle contrary to law before the hearing takes place. I don't see why there isn't a jury question on whether or not those things are or are not capable of hurting other people.
Well, I think there needs to be a showing of a real and substantial potential for repetition rather than a hypothetical possibility of an isolated incident occurring over and over again. That's what we have here.
Well, do isolated incidents occur over and over again?
Not with the facts of this case. I mean, the facts of this case were most unusual, and they never, and there was no showing they ever happened before. I mean, this was the one isolated incident.
As a matter of law, incapable of repetition.
Not likely to be repeated were the court's words.
Because it's not likely. Which part? The part about not responding to the district court or the part about selling it before the district court has its proceeding?
The latter, because that never happened before.
And there was, well, I mean,
the plaintiff had 500 transaction files. He couldn't make a showing that this kind of thing ever happened before. My client testified in his deposition that he pays attention to these notices when he gets them. Whether you want to order constructive notice, he should have had notice. I understand that. And that's why we settled the conversion claim. But I don't believe this gives rise to a per se. Certainly doesn't give rise to a per se. And I don't believe it was even an act of deception.
Your client handed the hearing notice form to the person. The person took it to the district court and paid a filing fee. A hearing was set. You didn't appear. There's nothing that a jury could find was deceptive about giving a notice to the person, inducing them to believe that giving them notice would actually be fruitful and make a difference.
Those notices.
Because then you then followed up by selling off the vehicle before the hearing was held pursuant to the notice that you gave him.
Those notices are handed out routinely to verify who ordered the towing. So
well, that sounds like it might be something that might be repeated then, if they're handed out routinely.
Well, they don't sell vehicles before decisions routinely, and that's what happened here. Furthermore, on the deceptive act, there needs to show substantial injury and unavoidable injury. And I believe that this injury could certainly have been avoided by seeking to enforce a district court order, by simply advising Mr. Blackburn, we have a court order that requires you to release the car. They didn't do that. They ran it to Superior Court, and they filed all kinds of lawsuits for bad faith and conversion. All of that could have been avoided. Certainly could have been avoided. And because it could have been avoided, it's not an unfair, deceptive act.
Thank you, counsel.
Very briefly.
I just want to ask your view on the last point that was made. The question of whether something can be avoided, do we view that in terms of it can be avoided because someone can prevail in another lawsuit against you, and then if they enforce that judgment against you, the damage won't be as great? Is that how we view the Consumer Protection Act?
I don't believe so, sir.
Okay.
The only thing I would say is that when we called after we contacted the tow yard and said, okay, we've gotten a ruling, and we were told it was sold. We weren't told who it was sold to. I just respectfully request that we be allowed to take this case to the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The next.